97.9 The Hill, WCHL, and UNC School of Media and Journalism present Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus, dedicated to in-depth examination of issues of overriding importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the Carolina campus, here's your host, UNC Journalism Professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topic today, a massive new contract in the NFL and the money paid to pro athletes in general. Our guest, Khaled Baluli, who teaches in the Department of Sport and Entertainment Management at the University of South Carolina. So, Khaled, here we go with Russell Wilson, $140 million over 4 years. $65 million of that is guaranteed. How in the world can anybody afford to pay somebody this much money to play a sport?
Yeah, it's an insane number, especially if you're not privy to a lot of the recent contracts in both the NFL and other major sports. But the reality is that the money actually is there for these owners, obviously living under that salary cap. The question starts becoming, what are the benefits of such a contract for these superstar athletes that can garner such luxurious contracts? But the money's certainly there. As someone who played professional sports and as someone who teaches it, I know a lot about the business side of what these leagues and owners are capable of accruing through sponsorships and TV deals and ticket sales. But like you said, it's hard on the normal fan side to understand how someone can be paid $35 million to toss around a football field.
All right. So you mentioned this. You did play 6 years. I think it was in the Brewers system in the minor leagues. How close did you get to $140 million?
I didn't get very close at all. As a matter of fact, I'm very close to the discussion going on right now about paying minor league baseball players more money, because for 6 years I was one of those, participants of a sample size that was making less than minimum wage if you played that out. So if you're following that conversation, I was on the other end of that spectrum, unfortunately.
All right. So with the contract being guaranteed at $65 million, just for our listeners, that means if he gets injured in preseason and can never play again, he still earns $65 million.
Correct. Yeah. And this is relatively new for the NFL. Major League Baseball has been the league that has brokered really good deals for its players. They obviously have a very strong union. So you see a lot of guaranteed contracts in Major League Baseball. And I think a lot of these NBA, NFL, and hockey players, to a lesser extent, are starting to use their popularity and likeness to try to influence what these owners are doing with their new contracts, which is kind of in the way of, we want more guaranteed money, especially noting that injuries are probably more prominent in the NFL than they are in Major League Baseball. So yeah, this really could shift the game a little bit in a lot of ways. It changes the market value for quarterbacks like Dak Prescott and Cam Newton, who are coming up on major deal negotiations. But it also, in addition to the size of the contract, the guaranteed portion of it really brings in a new element that most players prior to, you know, recent years have had to deal with.
So Aaron Rodgers did have the best deal or best yearly average. Wilson now has a better yearly average. The best deal total worth is Matt Ryan. He signed back in 2018 a 5-year deal, which is worth more than $140 million. So these are numbers, Khaled, that are just so hard for the average person to wrap his or her head around.
Yeah, and it's without getting into the analytics of it and looking at scores like BAMP score, like, you know, the average value that a player has above their market position. It's really hard to get into the details of explaining, in some respects, how some of these players are really worth their value. And others, especially seeing how they've played out in recent years, for example, like Derek Carr, are not. And so I think what the Seattle Seahawks are banking on is that they were about to lose or possibly lose the face of their franchise, a good community citizen, obviously a Pro Bowl caliber player, someone who's brought a Super Bowl to the city. And I think this was decision was made probably for the sake of sport fandom. And I don't know if we'll get into this later, but I don't know that this decision necessarily makes the Seahawks better contenders for runs at future Super Bowls.
All right. Tell me why you think that.
Usually when you look at contracts and they're decided and you see what a player is making and how long the contract is for, and you look at the salary cap hit, usually it's along a horizontal spectrum of saying, you know, does this put them in a prime position to win a Super Bowl, which is would be on the right-hand side of the spectrum, or does it put them in a position to maybe make a run at free agency and high draft picks, which in the NFL, you know, their draft is as important as any other sport. You know, if you can acquire a top three or four pick, it could really change. If you look at, for example, Patrick Mahomes, right? He's a most valuable player in more respects than one, not just his performance on the field, but the fact that he makes only a little over $3 million a year. So, and when he's worth so much more than that. So what this really does is it more gives it like a vertical spectrum to where I think the Seahawks move away from both of those ends of the spectrum. Russell Wilson guarantees you almost a chance at the playoffs every year, but he also limits your maneuverability in free agency and paying other top prospects to either stay with the Seahawks currently or to grab them in free agency. And so what ends up happening is you have a really good run, I think, a really good team, but do you have a Super Bowl capable team where you need the other pieces and parts? For example, the Seahawks don't have a prominent wide receiver outside of Doug Baldwin, who is approaching free agency himself. And so, we've known about their defensive line and defensive backs have leaving in free agency. So if they continue to lose players, but also not supply them through the draft with what will probably be lower draft picks if Russell Wilson is as good as he maintains being, you end up losing on both ends where you're not really making a run at making your team better through the draft and you're not necessarily able to punch through a Super Bowl because the rest of the team built around Russell Wilson isn't as good as it could be had you had more salary.
Sports Focus. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking about massive contracts and salaries of professional athletes. We're talking with Khalid Ballouli, University of South Carolina. So, Khalid, I think it's a super important point that you made earlier that regardless of how great the quarterback is or any individual player is, he can't win the game by himself. You have to have the supporting cast. And do you make it such that you can't have a great supporting cast when you give so much of a salary to one player?
Right. And this is where, this is where owners really have to look themselves in the mirror and ask themselves, what do you want for the city and what do you want for the franchise? I think by most metrics, analytics researchers and statisticians would look at this and say Russell Wilson is now probably not only a little bit, but way overvalued here in this contract, just from the standpoint of what the Seattle Seahawks will be able to do in free agency and the draft going forward. Like I mentioned earlier, having a guy like Russell Wilson at such an important position guarantees you, I think, a floor of a decent season, which probably guarantees you that you're never going to be in the top, 10, 15 picks of an NFL draft. But does his contract, is it worth so much to where now for the key holes? And another thing worth pointing just for the Seahawks in general is they were the most prominent run team in the NFL last year, or at least top two or three. So you not only paid a lot of money to Russell Wilson for his dynamic ability and his value to the organization, but to do so with Pete Carroll in an organization that is committed to a run heavy offense, it really puts more constraints on that position and that contract for the Seahawks in particular.
Okay. I want to get into looking at some of not the stars, the average players. But before we do that, one more touch on the $140 million. School teachers, firefighters, police officers, let's say $50,000 a year. That's probably about average. I think it's actually more like 45, but let's say 50. Somebody making $50,000 a year would have to work for 2,800 years to earn $140 million. So it goes back to the old saying, we value those who entertain us far more than we value those who sustain us. What does that say about us as a culture?
Yeah, well, it says something, and that's a question that hasn't been asked recently. You know, that's asked for decades. I remember when Alex Rodriguez had his infamous contract with the Rangers. That was a question that was raised then and continues to be raised. It's a tough question to answer. On one side, you look at it from a business standpoint and understand that from a market perspective, the number of consumers that are willing to tune in and pay premium prices for Sunday packages on their television screens, or pay premium packages to go to the fan cost index continues to get higher and higher, and that's how much an average family or average fan actually pays to go see one of these events. It continues to be more expensive, and TV deals are more lucrative, and fantasy sports and gambling have only made these sports that much more attractive. And I think what it comes down to is I don't know that it says that these are more important to us as a culture, but it certainly shows that with our discretionary time and our discretionary income, what are we willing to spend it on? And that, I think, says something about our culture a little bit. And I can see arguments on both sides of the coin. On one hand, you can certainly say, well, the money has to go somewhere. And so does it belong to, a group of 32 owners in Major League Baseball? Or does it, does it belong to the players who, go on the field every day and make a living just like anyone else and working hard in 162 ball games? On the other side of that coin, it comes down to, does anybody, need to be paid this much money, whether it's owners or TV, television broadcast companies or players, when we have such deficiencies in our, everything from bridges and railroads to teachers and firefighter salaries. So it's a really good discussion to have. It's one I'm certainly not going to answer here today, but it's certainly a cultural issue. It's a societal issue. And it's a discussion that we continue to have here on campus in our classes.
Yeah. So one of the arguments on the other side would be, yeah, they make a lot of money per year, $5, $6 million. In fact, the average salary in the NBA, and this is 2016-17, so that's a couple of years ago, was $6 million. Yeah, they make a lot of money, but, the average career is only 5 or 6 years. It's like, I'll take that. I'll take 6 years at $6 million.
Right. And I remember when I was coming out of college and was negotiating signing bonuses and entry level salaries and things like that. I had a good agent and they were very good about highlighting what this money means over the next maybe 2 to 3 years or 5 to 10 years for me versus the course of a lifespan where, someone in a quote unquote normal type career will make not only that, but more than what an average salary would be. And you're right. I mean, it's a very top. It's almost looking like at entertainers. We can look at Taylor Swift and Pink and Katy Perry for the money that they're making. But for every one of those superstars, you have hundreds, if not thousands, of artists that are struggling to make it. Staying in hotels as they tour. And so it there is just as much of a wide spectrum as there is in any type of career. If you break it down to its relative nature, these players are worth the money that they're bringing in based on, or the money that they're making in salary based on the money that comes in for these sports. But at the same token, there are those players like myself who played minor league baseball for 6 or 7 years and made below minimum wage, if you break it down to an hourly, scenario.
Sports Focus, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking about the salaries paid to professional athletes. We're talking with Khaled Baluli, University of South Carolina. So, Khaled, I want to go back to some of these average salary numbers. And again, these are a couple of years old. $6.2 million. Well, I don't know what the .2 even matters, but $6.2 million in the NBA. $3 million in the NHL, $2.1 million in the NFL. I guess that's offensive linemen dragging down the average, but still, that is. And here was a stat I found that would just blew my mind. And this is 2012, so that's several years ago, Tim Duncan made $13,000 for every minute he played in 2012. It's just, again, average people just can't fathom that kind of money. I don't, you know, most of us don't make $13,000 in a month.
Right.
He made it per minute.
Yeah, and the way these organizations, you know, I think, come to that determination is if you think about taking Tim Duncan off that team for whenever that Spurs franchise, I guess in 2012, and you look at the projected hit that they could have from not only a win-loss perspective, but from what he as a as an individual brand and a draw that, that he brings into the city of San Antonio, one could almost see how the hit could be. I make this argument in my class that LeBron James can almost be paid no fair market value based on what salary caps are for what his actual value is to an organization, especially when he was in Cleveland. Now that he's in the LA market, it's a little different. But what he brings to the city of Cleveland from a brand recognition standpoint, ticket sales and merchandise and the draw that he has of other players to come play with him, or that at least that he used to have, you could almost call it a priceless, value. And so it's all relative on how you look at it. No one should be, no reasonable person would look at any type of, work and say someone should be paid, you know, $15,000 per minute that they play or work in anything. But when you look at the actual value that someone has relative to the money that's being brought in, then you could come to some rational discussion about why someone actually is owed and deserves to be paid that.
And I'm really sort of upset with myself. You know, I should have spent way more time on the playground instead of in the classroom. So it's partly on me. Yeah.
Well, and you know, and so we joke about that, but what this does for a lot of demographic groups is it shows them that, you know, this is this becomes a pipe dream for a lot of players. They see this as a way of, I'm already really good at throwing a football or hitting a baseball or kicking a soccer ball, whereas in the classroom I see myself as being relatively average. Maybe I can get a piece of this pie, moving forward. Those are probably the statistics that need to be more sober for our youth and for our parents at a youth level. To realize how extreme these circumstances are. So, and that almost helps me rationalize how crazy it is that they're being paid this, because they are such extreme circumstances. I almost treat them as celebrities or superstars in our mind.
So, Colin, there has to be a limit somewhere, though. $35 million a year. I mean, when do we reach the point that you cannot pay anymore? You have the salary caps.
I think we have salary caps, but I really think in the next 5 years, you're going to see something happen. I think with Bryce Harper and Manny Machado not being paid until into spring training this year, and with some of these superstars still as being free agents in Major League Baseball, and going back to what I said earlier about with the Seahawks, I think there's going to be a price to be paid for these extreme contracts, and it's going to take a team of analytics as they become more prominent. You see, for example, I thought the Patriots were already leading the way in this regard. They refused to pay big. They basically wanted to ride out rookie contracts, which is the best value that you're going to get in any sport. And then they don't sign those expensive. If you believe in your draft system and in Major League Baseball, if you believe in your minor league, so you look at the Houston Astros, they believed in their minor league system to where they suffered for 5 years and to a pretty serious detrimental effect. I'm from the Texas area, so I knew it intimately. But the payoff was there. So the pain that they went through for about 3 to 4 years, they now have contracts that are so beneficial for their free agency signings, and they will be contenders for the next foreseeable future. The Seattle Seahawks, on the other hand, like I mentioned earlier, they're not guaranteed any great draft picks over the next few years because of this signing, and they could be limiting their Super Bowl potential because of this signing, which puts them in a very precarious situation. So these big contracts could be detrimental to teams, and I think you'll start seeing these owners start looking at caps differently and these big contracts differently. I don't see it happening in the next 2 years. We'll see what Dak Prescott and Cam Newton get in the coming years. But I think there's going to be a tipping point to where we see the salaries start coming back down.
And that does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guest, Khalid Baluli. Thanks also to engineer Gary Kirk. And as always, thanks to you for listening. Cheers.
Thanks to Richard Southall, Mark Nagel, and Deborah Southall at the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina for their research and guidance and for access to CSRI's international network of sources. Sports Focus is a service of UNC School of Media and Journalism.